Coming from the backwoods of New Jersey, welcome to the Jersey Guys Music Podcast, where we feature in-depth music discussions and interviews with special guests from the worlds of hard rock, heavy metal, and AOR music. So settle in and crank it up. Now, here are your hosts, the Jersey Guys themselves, Tom and Mark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Jersey Guys podcast. I'm Mark Ballow here with my co-host, Tom Coyne. Today, we've got special guest Derek Davis from Babylon AD. Derek, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, man. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, we appreciate your time tonight. So, hey, congratulations. Rome Wasn't Built in a Day just came out earlier this year. Congratulations on a new album.
Yeah, thank you very much, man. It's kicking ass.
Yeah, Tom told me, you know, hey, you got to pick this thing up when it came out, and I went and grabbed it, and it's a solid album, man.
Right on. Yeah, I'm glad you like it, man. We like it too.
Well, what we like to do here on the podcast is we kind of do a rundown of, you know, we kind of take the band back and the guy we're talking to on a little history run, and we go, you know, through all the albums and work our way up and everything. So I guess in that spirit, do you want to kind of talk a little bit about the first album? We'll get rolling with that, and we'll work our way towards a new one.
Whatever you guys prefer, man. It doesn't matter to me. I'm open book.
All right, then we'll roll cool. That way. Now, what I wanted to talk about with the first album is that really wasn't the first album, right? There was, like, you could kind of tell us how the band got together, and there were a lot of songs recorded before the Arista deal.
Well, technically that's the first album, because that's when we got a record deal. But we had probably about 15 songs recorded on demo tapes. But, you know, we put that out quite some time later just to give fans a little bit of preview of what the band was all about before we got a record deal.
So the songs that were recorded before that, mm-hmm. Why did you guys hold those off? Like, what was the process that when you got signed to Arista?
Well, when we got signed to Arista, I think we actually only kept two songs out of all the demos that we did.
Right.
For the album, you know, when you get your first, you know, big record deal and it's Clive Davis is judging every single damn song you got, you know, it's not just your A&R guy, you got Clive Davis listening to everything you do too. So, they really wanted to, in their minds, have something special that was different, you know, for their record label, since we were like the first rock act that was signed to their label. So, you know, a lot of the other songs that we thought were cool, you know, we thought they were great songs, and our fans thought they were great songs too, but, you know, they just wanted something, a little bit more, you know. Bangle the Bells ended up on the record, and, Sally Dance ended up on the record. Those were songs that we had demoed earlier, but, you know, about a year before.
So then there were outside writers that came into the process with Arista as well.
Well, then I started writing with Jack Ponte. I'm sure you guys know Jack Ponte from
Tom. Oh yeah, yeah. I wanted to ask you about him because he's obviously a Jersey guy, and it's someone I've always wished I could have interviewed, because I that guy has written with so many people and so many bands over the years. And I know he's just like a unique personality, or he was. Unfortunately, we lost him earlier this year. Talk about that whole process. There's five of the 10 songs on the first album were co-writes with you and Jack Ponte. What was that all like?
Well, they got a hold of Jack, and Jack listened to some of the demos that we did and everything. He said, yeah, I want to write with this guy, you know? So I flew out there and I stayed at his house for a couple of weeks, and he has a recording studio, you know, about 5 miles away from his house. And we just, every day we'd get up and we'd write a song together. And then by the time it was about maybe say 4 o'clock or whatever, you know, we start about 10 o'clock in the morning. By about 4 o'clock, we'd have the idea of a song and where it was going to go. And I'd be writing lyrics at the same time as we're writing the music. And, you know, we'd have the drum machine going, and usually we'd write like in his bedroom or something, you know, And then by the time we got to the studio, you know, the idea was pretty much formed of how the song was going to be, you know, and I'd write lyrics while we're in the studio as they were recording the guitars and the bass and the drums and things like that. We probably wrote one song a day or one song every other day, at least, you know? So I think we wrote, him and I wrote about 7 songs together for the first album. And then, the second album, we wrote a couple more songs together. It was just a great chemistry, man. Jack Pawnee is just, he taught me a lot, put it that way. He taught me a lot, you know, like, and we wrote, so for instance, like, let's take a song like Desperate. I had the song, you know what I mean? Desperate. I thought it was great. And Clyde thought it was good too, but he thought it could be better, you know? So of course he's talking to me and Jack, he's good. I just think it could be better. So the whole big chorus, you know, when the rain comes falling down, the big chorus, that was Jack's idea. You know, I had all the verse and I had a different kind of chorus, you know, which was cool, but it just didn't have that big everybody sing along type of thing, you know? So that's what Jack brought to the table, you know, because he'd work with, you know, Alice Cooper, Bon Jovi, I mean, Skid Row, I mean, everybody,
sure,
you know?
Yeah.
So Jack was a great guy, man. I miss him. I talked to him about maybe... about 3 months ago on the phone for a good hour.
Oh, wow.
You know, the funny thing is, man, he did not say shit. He didn't say nothing. I talk to him about once or twice a year, you know, on the phone. We communicate through emails and texts and stuff, but about once or twice a year, we make phone calls to each other. And we talk, you know, and then, but he never said nothing about him being sick at all.
Really?
It totally came out of the blue, man. I was totally blown away, but that's how Jack was.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you've always heard that, you know, he was kind of a mysterious guy.
Right.
Very, very private. But at the same time, man, if you get him on a rant, if he talks about the music business or something, man, he don't hold back, man. That guy could tell you some stories, you know. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about this because, you know, you work with Jack Ponte, great songwriter. I mean, you're a great songwriter in your own right. You know, the Babylon AD material, you've got solo albums throughout the years. I know you've also worked with some other songwriters, people like Taylor Rhodes, Jeff Paris. Yeah. Talk about when you write with these guys, like how do you find that kind of, you know, scenario where you're writing with people like outside guys as opposed to writing by yourself or whatever?
Yeah. I write with guys in my band too. You know, I've written with lots of different people just because a person is so-called classified as like a songwriter, you know, my guitarist, you know, I could say, well, they're a songwriter because it's the same process. Like Taylor Rhodes will just have a riff, you know, like, hey, what do you think about this? And then pretty soon I'll start forming melodies and, you know, putting the lyrics together to like a riff that he's got. And then we make it into a song. It's just, it's baking a cake, you know, there's never been a time when somebody just came to me, a songwriter, like, you know, a Gene Black or whoever, you know, maybe Taylor Rhodes or whatever, and said, hey man, I've already got a song and let's change it around. And then, you know, you get a co-writer or something like that. Mm. That's really never happened with me, you know?
Yeah.
It's usually pretty much 50-50, you know?
Okay.
All those guys taught me a little bit more about producing and things like that. Jeff Paris, Gene Black, you know, there was one song was kind of a strange, really strange. This one guy, God, I can't think of his name right now, off the top of my head, but he's written with lots of people, but he had a song called Every Woman Has a Price.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest with you, it was a corny ass song, you know, but Clive Davis loved the title.
That's a cool title. Yeah.
But he's like, Derek, you can make this song a hit just by the title alone. You know? So him and I worked on it for about, I don't know, a week or so, but it was just like hammer and nails, man. That song wasn't going nowhere, you know, cause it just wasn't from the heart. It was kind of like, hey, here's a great title and let's make a song around it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So the song came, it was kind of cheesy, you know? So we never put it out. We demoed it, but we're like, nah, we're not putting that one out.
Okay.
How did the original band come together? Like, if you give us a little bit of roots of how you guys met, like what was the original formation of the original Babylon AD lineup?
Originally, so right now there's me, Ron Fresky, and John Matthews, who are original members. We're the guys that started it in like 87. And John lived in Fremont with Jamie, our ex drummer, and Rob, the bass player, original bass player, went to high school with me. John and Jamie went to school together, and Ron went to school with us in Hayward. So we all played in bands together, like, you know, and we'd see each other at, you know, different gigs and things like that. And you kind of knew who was good players and things like that. And really got together with just I had played in a band with Jamie, the drummer, which was a pretty good band. I mean, we got a lot of recognition and did a lot of great shows, opened up for a lot of big bands, YNT and, you know, Sammy Hagar and all kinds of shit, you know, so we thought we were going to go somewhere. But the band fell apart. And then Jamie called me and said, hey, man, I'm playing with John Matthews. You know, we're jamming. It's just us two, man, but we got some really cool stuff. I think you should come down here, hear it, you know. So I went down to the studio that they were rehearsing at. And right off the bat, man, we wrote four songs within that one night. And, you know, it was kind of like magic, you know. And then I called Rob and we called Ron. And within a week, we were a band. And all we would just get together every about four nights a week, especially on Friday and Saturday nights. And we'd have big parties, you know, and we'd just jam ideas, you know, and write songs.
Nice.
So the first album came together when you got signed by Arista. What was that project? How did you get that? And at the time you said that was the first hard rock band that they signed. How were you able to get that deal?
Well, so I had been writing with Jack Pawnee, right? And this is before we had our deal. They had set our A&R guy had set it up because he believed in us, but he just thought we were too green. I mean, we really were, man. We've just written a bunch of songs, and the band had just been together, and we just, you know, partied a lot, and you know, we were sowing our oats and doing our thing and playing around the Bay Area. And they, you know, like I said, I went out and started writing some songs with Jack. And as soon as I wrote Desperate, Clive called me up and said, hey, I want to see you guys pretty soon, you know? And I was really excited. You know, I didn't know when that was going to happen, but he just said, based on this song right here, I want to see you guys pretty soon. So a couple months go by and, you know, and it's always in the back of my head, you know, Clive Davis called me, you know, and he said he wanted to see us, you know, and months go by. And then, the band moved down to Los Angeles and, cause we're all from the San Francisco Bay Area, you know, and literally, man, I think we moved there on a Wednesday or Thursday. And then two nights later, we got a phone call from our manager saying, hey, Clive Davis wants to see you tomorrow.
Wow.
You're like, holy shit. And they already, you know, Arista already got a rehearsal studio for you over at SIR. And they want to see you at 10 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, we were like, you know, we didn't practice. All we did was get down to Hollywood and fucking party like nuts. I mean, you get the rainbow and the whiskey and, you know, we just, you know, and so we set up our stuff, man. And we got up on a big stage and we ran through seven songs, and Clive Davis was there with two suits from New York. And the A&R guy, Randy Gersten, was there, the head of the West Coast, and our manager, the five guys sitting on a big giant couch right in front of us. And man, we just ripped through those seven songs. As soon as we were done, it was like, you know, it's basically do or die. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there was nobody there except for just us five guys in the band, a couple guys in the road crew, sound guy, and the five guys sitting on the couch, you know, they were all in suits. And as soon as we hit the last chord, bam, Clive just literally in my mind, you know, I see him as jumping up, you know, but he kind of jumps up out of the couch and goes, welcome to the family, boys. And we look at each other like, what the fuck? So I said, does that mean we're going to get a record deal? You know? And he said, absolutely. Our lawyers are going to get in contact with you. We're going to get you guys we're going to make you guys bigger than Aerosmith. I remember him saying that. And we're like, really?
Wow.
Yeah. So that's cool. How that happened.
Well, at that time you had songs that probably not only rivaled Aerosmith were better. I mean, that first album was for me as a fan, when it came out, I thought for that era was one of the best, like From Soup to Nuts was one of the best albums. Did you guys view, obviously you were high on your material, but did you see it as something that would have been like, you know, big on MTV and envision big things from it?
I thought so. I mean, you know, you're living in a bubble, man. Once you get a record deal and everybody's patting you on the back and, you know, you're invited to all the parties. The next thing you know, you're hanging out with Sylvester Stallone. You're like, wow, this is crazy. You know what I mean? How did I get here? You know, you start believing your own hype, you know what I mean? What everybody's telling you. So of course we thought we were going to be superstars or something like that, you know, and Clive Davis was definitely telling us that. He'd call me like about once a month and talk to me on the phone, or he'd fly me out to New York and I'd sit there and I'd do A&R meetings with them, you know, and listen to all the songs, you know, the Jeff Healey and the Whitney Houston and, you know, Barry Manilow, whatever. And I'd be sitting there choosing songs just like the rest of them. And I was just a guy in a band, you know?
Wow.
So I really thought that, you know, we were going to move and going to get somewhere. I think our downfall though, you know, after all these years looking back why the band didn't get bigger is if if you remember at that time, like 89, 90, 91, everybody was a 1-2 punch. You put out a hard rock song and then boom, you hit a big ballad.
Right.
Everybody had the same.
That was the blueprint.
Yeah.
Right. Right. And everybody broke on their ballad. The first one was like, okay, get to know the band. The second was like, you know, bam, like, here's a ballad. Now we're going to be superstars, you know?
Yeah.
And what happened with us, we put out Hammer Swings Down. Then they said, okay, we think we're going to go Desperate, but no, let's do Bangle the Bells. Said, right on. Okay, let's do Bangle the Bells. So then that's two hard rockers, right?
Mm, right.
And then Orion Pictures approached us and said, hey, we want to use Kid Goes Wild and RoboCop. So we'll pay for the video. We'll pay for everything. And Arista was like, yeah, let's do it, man. This is like free promotion, you know? And we're like, well, wait a minute. What about Desperate? The album's been out like a year now, you know?
Yeah.
We're like, what about Desperate? Oh, don't worry, man. We're going to get to Desperate. We promise. We're going to get to Desperate. You know, the A&R guys and the radio guys. We're going to get to Desperate. And we're like, okay. Mm. So we do Kid Goes Wild. Now it's like 15 months of freaking albums out. You know what I mean? And we're like, are we going to put the song out? And they're like, no. The album's been out too long. We want you guys to go back to the studio and make another album. So it really killed our momentum.
Right. You missed the curve on a phenomenal ballad. Phenomenal ballad that didn't get the right bump.
It's rough because how many bands get four singles deep into their debut album, right? Where it's like, wow.
Four singles, four videos. I mean, you know, and we did a lot of touring and stuff like that. We did the States 8 different times, about 2 months apiece. A lot of people don't know that about us. They just think we played a few gigs here and there or something like that. But maybe we toured all the time, you know?
Well, you played in Brooklyn. You appeared in my friend's record store in Zigzag in Brooklyn.
Yeah, we played Lemoore's, I remember.
That's right. That's right. You did. You were in there the day after, actually, that you played Lemoore's. You were in the record store.
That was a cool club.
Yeah.
Oh, that was legendary.
I'm friends with James Lomenzo, and he was from that area too.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So now the process is a second album. How many album deal were you guys signed to at Arista?
We were signed to a 10 million dollar deal.
Yeah, everybody we interview that was on a big label from that era to say the same thing.
Albums, 10 albums.
We had Rob Lamont from the River Dogs.
They have their out, you know?
It's the same thing, a 10 album deal, and they did one album and they dumped them.
Yeah, so ours was a guaranteed 2 album no matter what, you know?
So that did the vibe change now? Like we're a couple of years now. We're unfortunately rolling into a more unsettled period for hard rock. Did the vibe change with the record label now? 2 years down the road,
I think they just like everybody else was kind of shell shocked when Nirvana came on and MTV just canceled all. You know, you hard rock bands with long hair, we're gonna call you hair bands, and you guys are canceled.
Hmm.
Basically what it was, right? On a Friday, you're riding high. On a Saturday, this new band comes along and killed everybody.
Sure.
And I remember we were in the recording studio and Tom Werman was our producer, you know, and he did Girls, 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 Ted Nugent. I mean, he Cheap Trick, everybody, you know? So it was like a dream working with Tom Werman. And we're in the recording studio and we're in the mixing stages. And, you know, I was always in the studio for everything, you know, getting more knowledge from Tom and different people, you know what I mean? The engineers and things like that, so that I could become a producer someday myself. But I remember I was sitting in the studio out in the lounge and, you know, a big TV is playing. And then Nirvana came on and it was late at night, like probably Headbangers Ball or something. And I said to myself, man, these guys are cool. You know, this is badass. I like this, you know? And so I go in the studio, I say, you see a band Nirvana? Yeah, everybody's been talking about them, you know? And so we talked about them for about a minute. Yeah, they're going to be big, man, you know? Within, by the time our album came out, like about 4 months later, after we had it mixed, it was basically, it was kind of like dead in the water, right?
Yeah.
Every band that I knew was getting dropped. As our album came out, all these bands were getting dropped.
Yeah.
We're like, shit, man, that don't bode well for us, you know? It took a year before we were dropped, but a lot of bands got dropped. Even like Warren got dropped. You're like, how could they get dropped? They just sold 2 million records, you know, a year ago. So the writing was on the wall, man, you know.
And I never really asked anybody. It's always been my own theory. Do you think it ran a little bit deeper than just grunge? I personally thought like the rap was coming on really strong.
Yep.
Gangster rap, you know, the pop, female pop singers. Like there was a lot of stuff under, Like grunge gets the bad rap for killing hard rock, but I think there was a lot of stuff. Because if you think about it, the labels gave up on grunge within 3 or 4 years too, and then it was no more rock at all.
I know. I absolutely. You're correct about that. It wasn't just grunge that killed it. It was a combination of everything. I mean, everything has its day, right? I mean, I remember being on, looking in some of the magazines, and here I am looking just like the other guys that are looking just like me. And it's like, it's just, it's like there's
oversaturation too.
Everybody's just got the same long hair, the same look and everything. And the record label, the funny thing is, when we first came out on our first album, we kind of had our own kind of cool vibe. You know what I mean? A little bit different. Our albums was different than all the other kind of cheesier kind of, metal that was coming out,
Yeah, definitely.
But, and it was like, it was a good sound. And then by the second album, all we got from the record labels, be more like Warrant, be more like these guys, be more like them guys. You know what I mean? So it was a lot of people interfering with what we look like, how we dressed, how we presented ourselves, it's like, be more like these guys. It's like, cause they just sold 2 or 3 million records, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
We're like, why can't we just be ourselves, man? Mm.
No, you guys definitely didn't have that look, because I have a big promo post, a black and white promo poster from the first album. And you guys almost had like a more of like a new wave of British heavy metal. You had like a lot of leather, and it wasn't like a real glammy look. It was more like a badass early 80s look.
I remember we had a lot of makeup on because everybody was telling us to do that. You got to do this.
You know,
and Motley Crue had lots of makeup, and Twisted Sister was like, put a lot of makeup on. We're like, oh shit, okay, man.
Right.
Well, is that where, you said it was a year or so after the whole kind of 92 when the second album came out. Was that where the Lost Sessions 93 EP came out? Like, was from that era? Like, you were kind of like, it took that another year for you guys to kind of ultimately get dropped?
Yes. Those songs were written for the third album.
Okay.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, there were just demos that we did in Fresno, and they sat, in my studio for years and just sat there until one day I listened to some of them, and I went, it's not too bad. It's kind of rough, and I didn't have the masters or anything like that. Who knows what happened to the masters, but I had it sounded decent, and people were asking, don't you guys have something else? Don't you have something else? And I was like, well, yeah, I do. know what I mean? If somebody wants to hear it, sure, let's put it out. We had nothing to lose. And, we had some gigs coming up and things like that. So it was like, throw some promo out there, So we did that.
Now, you later resurfaced with the Blitzkrieg album. What was that was a Paris?
2000.
Yeah.
Paris Records.
Paris signed that. Yeah.
Yeah. They distributed it. We put our own record label together called Apocalypse Records. And then Tom at Paris, picked it up and distributed it out throughout the world and stuff like that. And it was a good, that record actually sold pretty damn good, man. Without having what we have nowadays, Facebook and all that kind of stuff, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We didn't have social media really in 2000.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And it sold pretty damn decent, that was one of my favorite albums to make. I think because we had no outside interference from nobody or anyone telling us what to do. So the guys were able to bring in heavier licks or just do whatever we wanted to do. We were like, fuck it. We don't got to prove anything to anybody. Let's just play whatever we want to play. That's how we went about doing that album. Hmm.
That was a good album. It had like a lot of edge to it. Like the, you'd see like it was coming from the heart. There was no record executives hanging over you telling you.
Well, we weren't like, we got to write a pop song to get on the radio. Right.
Yeah.
No fucking deal, you know?
Now, the Revelation Highway, it's something I'm glad I'm finally talking to you. That encompassed some songs from before the Arista period, obviously.
That's correct.
Terrific album. I mean, from top to bottom. I mean, that album came out, I was just floored by it. What made you go back to the archives and encompass it with some other? It was a great combination of the way the whole album flowed, considering some of the songs were quite old songs at the time. Yeah.
Well, some of those songs, like let's say Last Time for Love, Saturday Night, those were songs that were written for the first album, Tears. that was written for the first album.
Right.
And they were with John Matthews had joined the band. These were basically his music kind of, you know, and, you know, mine too, but mainly the ideas were John's. So John has a more melodic type of feel to his guitar playing and his stuff that he gives me. And we'd always wanted to do them. And we had tons of fans bugging us over the years that had heard the demos and things like that, saying, man, these songs would be great if they were recorded properly, you know? So we just decided, like, you know, sure, we had new material and stuff, but why can't we put out something or just because a song's 30, 25 years old or whatever the fuck it is, you know, who gives a shit as long as it's a good song.
Right.
You know what I mean? So that's how we went about doing that. We just, we picked some of the songs that we always thought were going to be on our first album. We thought they were going to be on the first album until, you know, the record label gets a hold of you and starts molding you what they want.
Right. Right?
So, you know, a combination of new songs and old songs. And we put that on Frontiers Records.
Now that Frontiers, they knew that that's how you were going to present the album, that was, you know,
So they contacted us and they said, hey, we heard you guys are doing in the studio working on a record. We said, yeah. And they said, well, can we hear some of the stuff? And I said, absolutely. So about a week later, I send them about maybe 6-7 of the tracks. And they were like, that sounds good to us. You know, let's get a deal going. And so we signed a one album record deal with them. And, you know, they put the album out and the rest is history for that one. Hmm.
I know it got a good response at the time when it came out.
It got a good response. I think this one's getting a lot better response, though.
Yeah, I think, like, people, my own opinion, people are starting to gravitate more to the hard rock in the last couple of years. Like
that. Yeah, it's hard to say, man, you know, because sometimes we'll play gigs that are just like, man, off the hook, lots of fans and shit's crazy. And then we'll play somewhere, you know, like we played a casino. In this town called Oroville. I never even heard of the damn town, you know, it was an Indian casino. And it was kind of a bummer, man, because, you know, you're on a big giant stage and, you know, place probably holds 2,000 people and there was probably 250 people there. You know what I mean?
What state was that in?
It was in California.
California. Okay.
But everyone I talked to said, I never even heard of this place. I never heard of this casino. I never even heard of this town. I'm like, me neither, man, but we got booked there and they pay great, you know? So sometimes you run into that, you know what I mean? Where you just, you know, our drummer was kind of bummed out going, what happened, man? We just played Monsters of the Mountain and it was packed. And we played this other gig and it was packed. And we play here and there's 200 or 300 people. I'm like, man, that's just the way it is, dude. I said, think about it, you know, great bands were playing, you know, Nazareth was playing Coliseums. Now they're playing clubs. I mean, it happens to everybody. Man.
Yeah. Even back in the day, you know, we talk about it all the time with other bands and artists. There was certain band, like hard rock in the early 80s to mid 80s was very regional.
Yeah.
You know, you could be great in a 3-state radius and you move from that and there's 10 people in the club.
Exactly. Yeah. You just never know, man. You know,
I used to go to a club in Manhattan called the Cat Club, and they used to bring in a lot of West Coast bands.
Yeah, we played Cat Club.
You played the Cat Club? Okay, I didn't see you there, but I saw a lot of bands from the West Coast, Lizzie Borden, Vicious Rumors, Leather Wolf, and a lot of those bands, as hot as they were on certain areas, you would see them in New York City on a Wednesday night, and there'd be 75 people in the club.
Yeah.
But you'd see some dipshit local band from New York, New Jersey on a Lamore's on a Saturday night, and there'd be 1,000 people in the club. You couldn't walk in.
I know. You know, it's crazy, too. There's a lot of these cover band or tribute bands now.
Well, that's everywhere. Right. Yeah. Right.
I mean, they're everywhere. And, you know, they got some big followings. But if you some of these bands and or, you know, some of them we've been open for us, and you're just kind of shaking your head going, I don't get it.
Right.
Guy is like 300 pounds overweight and this other guy
I don't get it either.
We 90 turn, years we, old yeah. and then, you know, this other guy just learned how to play the drums, but hey, they're doing Aerosmith. So
right. I don't get it either. It's just something that, that's a whole nother, we could have a whole podcast dedicated to that.
I mean, I'm sure there's some good ones, but I've never run across one yet.
No, there really isn't. I mean, you know, there's some, they're like, there's certain tribute bands and then there's novelty ones. I mean, I've seen, my girlfriend's a Guns N' Roses nut. I've seen a bunch of them. There's guys that actually dress up and Slash and, you know, it's all different types of
the. Yeah.
Yeah. It's
to each own, man. It's, you know? Yeah. If that's a, if
right. I didn't grow up from that era, so like I can't identify. This is like a new phenomena, this cover band thing.
I mean, I like playing. I put together a band just so that we could play some of those cover band clubs because people were telling us you can't get in just doing original gig, you know, because I had some original acts and I was having trouble, you know, not Babylon ID, like just my stuff. And so, you know, I said, I know what I'm going to do. So I called Danny De La Rosa, my guitar player from Babylon ID. And then I called a drummer who used to play with Greg Kent. I called the bassist from Montrose. I said, how about if we do this? Here's how we're going to get into these, break into these clubs. What if we put together a band that just plays four bands? And that way we could be called a tribute band. We play Aerosmith, we play UFO, we play Thin Lizzy, and we play Montrose. And we do five songs of each band. You know what I mean? And it's all the shit we grew up with in high school, junior high school. So it was like, yeah, this is going to be cool. You get to play UFO, Aerosmith, you know, Thin Lizzy, you know? So it was like, well, I guess they're kind of a tribute band, you know?
Yeah.
We did a lot of gigs around the Bay Area for a couple of years doing that shit.
Well, what was, I mean, back here in Jersey, and I'm a little bit younger, I'm 54. Tom's about 10 years older than me. I'm not sure where you sit in our age group here. But I know back in Jersey at the time, like, in maybe like the late 70s, it started out as like the scene, the local scene. It was a lot of cover bands, like you talked about, not tribute, but cover bands, you know?
Yeah.
And that was a big thing. And then, you know, the original bands came along and that broke. Obviously, the 80s, tons of bands getting signed, major label deals, playing arenas and whatnot. Was it like that in San Francisco? Was And it kind of went full circle because, like I say, now we're talking about being back at the tribute band thing is the big thing now. Was it like that out in San Francisco?
Absolutely. The whole club scene out here, there must have been 10 clubs from San Jose to San Francisco, Oakland to, you know, wherever, Berkeley, Albany, I mean, Hayward. Their clubs were packed every Friday and Saturday night. And there was a time, there was probably a 3 or 4 year period when I probably went out four nights a week, like Tuesday night to be a jam at this place. Wednesday, it'd be cool over here. Saturday and Friday, there'd be, you know, different gigs. The Bay Area was hopping, man. It was like, it was just on fire. And I was always in a band playing at all these gigs, and bands like Metallica were playing backyard parties and I would plan backyard parties with them. You know what I mean? Mm. It was kind of crazy. And, you know, Chuck Billy and those guys had their thing. Death Angel, they had their thing. And all the original bands just started, you know what I mean? We started doing shit, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it was great, man. And then somehow it just got killed off, man. You know, it just, people change. I mean, you know, I've got a three boys now, you know, they're all in their 20s and they don't even go out to any clubs or do anything. You know, they play at their freaking computers all day long and shit. If they listen to music, it's some kind of rap thing or whatever's the cool TikTok song of the week, some bullshit like that. They'll come out and maybe see my band, you know, something like that. But they don't like hunt down shows like we did when we were kids. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was all the time, man.
That was my life.
It was mine too, man. It wasn't only just for music, you know, it was for something else. Right. Too.
Well, that too.
Right.
Well, there was a couple of motivation.
Yes. Yes. It was a multi-pronged fascination and what out of that. Oh, yeah.
Well, let's go. 2017 was Revelation Highway. Let's fast forward 7 years. The new album, Rome Wasn't Built in a Day, just came out. Like I said, you know, back when we started this, Tom, when it first came out, I just, whatever, it was under my radar. And Tom was like, did you pick up the new Babylon AD? I was like, not yet. He's like, you need to get it. You really like pumped it up.
Yeah, know? No, I did. Cause the songs were super immediate. You know, I don't expect immediate songs anymore because my bar over the years has been lowered. So when I pick up something and the songs are like really immediate, it grabs my, and there's at least four or five songs on this album. The first time I heard them, I'm like, wow, it's a fucking really good song for a band that's been around a long time to write a song that is that strong. And that's what I had told Mark. It's, you got to hear this. There's some really good songs on this.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. Yeah. I took a lot. I've been in the studio all day. The last 3 days I've been in the studio working on new material for the next album. And I think it's going to be just as good or better than this album.
Really?
You know, I really do, man. I really do.
I wanted to ask you that because it was obviously 7 years between albums, the last two. So we're not going to be getting 7 years again, huh?
No, I, you know, there was a lot of internal shit going on with the band for years, man. And it would bubble up sometimes and go away and then bubble up sometimes, you know, and then the whole COVID thing hit. We had demoed we demoed about half the songs for this album before even COVID hit. And then COVID hit and kind of threw everybody in a, you know, go this way, that way. So I did a couple albums, you know, a blues album and a soul album. And I just did shit that I felt like I wanted to put out or do, you know what I mean? Or wrote. And I did a few singles, but in the back of my mind, I always wanted to do something with Babylon AD and it, again, but it wasn't until Paris Records approached me a couple years ago and said, "Hey man, you know, have you ever thought about doing another record?" I said, "Just so happens we do have some demos, you know, we've got some demos." And he said, "Well, you got any live stuff?" I said, "Yeah, I've got some live stuff recorded at a couple of recent shows, you know, that are maybe about a year old or whatever. I can listen to them, see if they're, you know, usable. So we can maybe use that as a stepping stone to promote the new live album, Live Lightning, which we put out last year, to like let everybody know, hey man, they're back on the scene. Oh, Babylon AD's around again, that kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But this time I don't think we're going anywhere because we have, you know, we got the right players in the band, the right attitude. And the band is just, we're a writing machine. You know, I got four guys that write besides me now, you know, and usually it's just me and one or two other guys. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, it's a lot easier to keep on writing, to keep on being creative. We've got radio now, we've got some management, you know, we've got some stuff, some gears working that we haven't had in the past. And, you know, everybody's a little bit older and a little bit smarter and, you know, with their time, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll see what happens. You know, we're not expecting to all of a sudden, hey man, you guys, 20 years later, you're rock stars or some bullshit like that. You know,
yeah.
It's like, no, man, we're more down to earth now. We just like to have fun. It's kind of like a, you know, I liken it to like, let's say, you're a basketball player and now you're 52 years old. Well, you can't run with the Curry anymore, but you could be playing with all your buddies that are the same age as you that were all stars at one time.
Right.
You know what I mean? Kind of like that.
So one of the things I like about the new album is you've developed your voice and the band, a very signature sound. So when I heard this, it sounds very similar to the early stuff. It's not like, because unfortunately, bands kind of like try to introduce new sound. And I realize at this stage of the game, we want to hear like, not a replica, but like what Babylon AD really sounded like in 88, 89, 90. And this sounds like that band. It has that same vibe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I consciously was thinking that most of the time when I was writing the songs and also when I was producing the songs, I listened to the first album quite a bit to get that thickness that we had on that first album. And just the sound, I'm trying to figure out a way to get that sound, and it has to do with the songs and the way they're put together and stuff like that. So you're right, man. I made sure that the band, we were fully aware that we were trying to capture what we had, the magic we had before. We didn't want to all of a sudden, you know, go off on left field and go, hey, look at me now, I'm more creative, I could do this, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I write songs all the time. So if I want to be different creatively, then I could just do that myself.
Right.
You know what I mean? So
I can speak for myself for a lot of fans. I mean, we interact with fans and people that are into this all over the world. A lot of us are tired of bands trying to reinvent the wheel. So if you like Babylon AD, you want to hear Babylon AD. You don't want to hear like some weird kind of like, you know,
well, I was saying
replica of it.
Yeah.
I heard some weird stuff came out of Guns N' Roses a few months back. Oh, and I was like, what is that?
Right. Well, that's another perfect example. Like,
is that AI? What the fuck is that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just me though, man. You know, maybe I'm totally wrong.
No, because we lived through this in the 90s where every band, you know, from that era tried to go grunge, and then 2000, they try to reinvent another way. You know, I mean, Dokken was guilty of that as a perfect example until they finally went back to. And the reality is the fan base that all of these bands have right now is we want to hear what that band sounded like that we loved so much.
Yeah, I agree 100%, man. I love it. Like when I hear the bands, it still sound the same, but it's a new song.
Right, you know, right.
1990, but here it is, man. It still sounds the same. You know, it's like, this is my bread and butter. It's kind of like the first three or four albums that Aerosmith made. That was my bread and butter that I grew up on. Trying to learn how to sing and write and everything. It's like, man, that's it. And then when they put out Pump and all this other stuff, I was like, eh. No. It sounds, it's commercial, but it's kind of cheesy and it's kind of thin.
That's how I felt too. 70s Aerosmith was phenomenal.
I was like, where's the grit, man? Right. Where's the toughness? Where's the fuck you? Now I was just like,
absolutely.
Hey, money.
Absolutely. You know, like, oh, the draw the line period, like it rocks. Mm-hmm. Even A Night in the Ruts was a great album.
Night in the Ruts
was such an underrated great album by them.
Yeah, that was a great album. Walking in the Sand.
Yeah, where they did that cut. Yeah, tremendous. That was, yeah, they were so great. And then they did that. They abandoned their fan base and they really never recaptured it either.
I think what happened was, you know, the record label said, you know, Geffen said, hey, man, you know, we got to get you guys straight. And we got, you know, teams of songwriters. We're going to write with you guys and we're going to help you get back on top. We're going to get Dionne Warren in here and we're going to, you know, write Love in an Elevator. We're going to put you guys back on top. And they're like, fuck, sign me up, man.
Yeah.
So when you had Jack Ponti, in other words, he didn't disrupt what you guys were onto. He just fit into.
No, not at all. He just kind of basically helped me understand a little bit the bigger sense of hooks, you know. So if you listen to something like on their first album, Sally Dance, right? I wrote that whole song, right? I wrote Shot of Love, right? But you know, Shot of Love has like kind of like the bigger chorus type of thing, you know what I mean? But Sally Dance doesn't. It's totally like a different kind of song, you know, with the stick and the bluesy kind of thing going on or whatever. But he kind of and Bangle the Bells we wrote ourselves, you know, that's got a big chorus and it's got a big thing. I think he just kind of helped us get like just a little bit more of a commercial edge, I guess you'd say, to be more radio friendly, I guess. I don't know even how to put in the word, to be honest with you. But all I know is he helped me with songwriting. You know, I don't want to say cookie cutter because it did. Some of it was kind of cookie cutter after a while. You know, some of the bands that he wrote with, I started hearing elements of stuff that him and I wrote. He gave me and I would like, nah, I'd pass on it. Cause sometimes he'd give me like 20 songs in a month and I'd listen. Nah, I don't like that one. Nah, I don't like this one. Nah, I don't like this one. You know what I mean? Because they started all sounding the same. You know what I mean? It could be, they just could be, you know, Baton Rouge or something. Yeah. They could be whoever.
Right.
You know,
well, that was another band that he had a big hand.
Or they could be Alice Cooper song. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's a great song, but it's not Babylon AD, man. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So what are you thinking? Like maybe the end of next year, end of 2025, we'll see another album?
Yeah. So the next album we're trying to get it out by around August, September at the latest. That's what our goal is. We have like a whole calendar written up for everybody in the band when the new material's got to be the latest date it could be in by for me to write lyrics to, things like that. We got some gigs planned, you know, we're going to go do some shows in Europe next year too.
Oh, wow.
And the next single though, maybe you guys don't know, but, the next single is going to be Face of God.
Really?
Yeah.
Face of God. And that's going to come out, December 1st. And so we're going to hit radio hard. Hopefully some people will pick it up, you know, and play it. And we've got a video coming out for it and everything. And, you know, we're just chugging along. We're having fun. You know, that's the main thing. If people aren't having fun at our age by now playing music, man, you might as well just give the fuck up. You know,
we talk about the studio side of things. You guys, I guess in the last maybe 10 years or so, and just this past summer, right, you did the Monsters of Rock cruises. You did the Monsters on the Mountain and stuff. How is it getting back and doing those bigger sort of higher profile type shows?
Yeah, those are always fun, man. They're always a blast because it's kind of like you get paid to go on vacation.
Yeah.
You know? That's the way I look at it all the time. We're like, fuck, we get paid to go on vacation, man. You know?
Well, Tom's been on a couple of cruises over the last few years, and we've talked about this over the time. We're like, you know, these Monsters Rock cruises would really be cool, but it's like, I don't know, you know? It's like, we got to see. It's like, I'm not sure if I want to be on a
I've been on a lot of cruises, never a Monster like, or Rock cruise.
I don't know if I want to be on a boat with like 3,000 crazy people like that. I'd probably never get any sleep.
You probably wouldn't, man. I never did.
Right.
That's right.
So I have a question for you because I grew up a huge Southern rock fan and you did an album called Moonshine that had, were you a Southern rock aficionado?
Uh-oh.
We're talking about this. Everybody wants this right now, man. I get hit up for this all the time.
What is it, out of print? I have it sitting right here. It's out of print.
You got the CD?
Yeah.
Right there.
Oh, people want to take that from you, man.
Really? I'm guessing it's out of print.
I can't find it anymore. You know, it's just on digital for some reason. Why? I don't fucking know. But that was a great album, man. It was fun to make. You know, all the players were top notch. You know, Michael Anthony was involved. Jane Child sang and played piano. It was just a rocking band. And every time we'd play, people like, you know, Zach Wilde would show up and jam with us, you know, and fucking, you know, just everybody. It was like a great party band. I mean, it was a real Southern blues rock band. You know what I mean?
Were you a fan of that music?
Yeah. I mean, I loved like Skynyrd when I was a kid and the Outlaws and stuff like that.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Huge fan. That was probably my favorite in the 70s. That was probably my favorite music.
Yeah. I remember seeing the Outlaws and Lynyrd Skynyrd at the Winterland in San Francisco.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
And, you know, they did Green Grass and High Tides Forever with that three guitar players. Great. Doing that fucking lead. Oh, man. Great. God, that was bad a song.
I saw them with Molly Hatchet at the Capitol Theater in in 1980, yeah. I think, 79 or 80. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's I'm always surprised that there's not more bands trying to.
I know, me too.
Jump on that, because man, that's a big hole right there that you know, that could be fulfilled. You know, if there's a young band that's, you know, in their early 20s wanting to do that kind of shit, man, it would catch up.
Right way. There's a lot of bands that are pushing them off themselves like that, but they're really when I listen to it, it sounds like new country music. You know, people always tell, you got to hear it's a Southern rock band. And then you put, it's not really Southern rock. It's country music in a thin disguise. I'm talking, you know, like Blackfoot, like that type of ass kicking over the top Southern heavy stuff. Exactly. And you're right. There's literally no band that I know of, young band, that's doing that.
Yep. I don't know either.
It's really weird, because that is kind of like a foot in the door, you would think, for like a new scene of music, because it's totally evaporated. Mm-hmm. So when I got this album, I kind of figured that was something that was a love of yours, that you never got to record that type of music.
Yeah. And, you know, we got to record some of it, about half of it, over at the Eddie Van Halen's 5150 studio. So that was a cool thing. The band was just a great band, man. And just I blew it, because I quit, you know, and I shouldn't have quit. It was just one of those things where I was going through like a midlife crisis or whatever. You know what I mean? I was in my early 30s thinking like, what's the fucking point, man? I lost my deal with Arista, you know, and here I was in this great band. But, you know, after about a year and a half in this band, I was just like, you know what? Fuck it, man. I think I'm done with music. Mm-hmm. I really thought that. I mean, that's how crazy I was. And then I just joined the police department. I started I thought I was going to be a cop. Hmm. I must have been out of my fucking mind. I joined the OPD, the Oakland Police Department. My wife thought I was crazy. Everyone thought I was a fucking nut. And I guess I was.
Well, that's what midlife crisis do to you.
I was out on the street for a couple of weeks. I was like, fuck this, man. I resigned. They were like, you can't resign. We put too much money in you. I said, I'm resigning anyways, man. I don't give a shit. I'm going to be a musician again. Right. And everybody that I knew was like, the shit I seen in Oakland, man, I wouldn't wish on my
I can only imagine.
Anyone would be a cop. You got to be fucking mine. And I guess I was.
So my last question, which I actually wanted to ask at the very beginning, where did the band name Babylon AD come from? How did you guys come up with that?
Well, what happened was we were a band called the Persuaders, right? And we had all the chicks all the time, all the gigs, man. It was pretty funny, because we were playing rock music, right? And 90% was all originals, you know, at all the clubs. But we'd have all these chicks in front of us, and they'd be dancing to our shit. You know what I mean? So we thought we were going to stick with that. And so we got down to Los Angeles, and whenever we started doing the record, somebody said, hey, man, there's already a band called The Persuaders. We go, who? Oh. And there was, and you probably remember that song when you were a kid. It's a thin line between.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I was the Persuaders.
Right.
I'm like, oh, fuck. So we had to change our name. So I remember just we happened to be walking by a vintage store. And I think it was called Babylon, or they had a Babylon shirt or whatever. I go, that's what we're going to be called, Babylon. You know what I mean? So that stuck. And then some band came out of the Midwest and said, hey, we're going to sue you because we're called Babylon. And our, of course, the lawyers got involved and everything. Well, what do you want? Well, we want $10,000. $10,000. Okay, whatever, man. And we tagged on the AD. Okay. You know? Hmm. Yeah, that's how that all came about.
Interesting.
There yeah. You go. Well, Derek, I mean, hey, we appreciate this walk down memory lane. Everybody get look out for the new single, December 1st, you said, right?
God, yep, December 1st should be out.
Okay, great. All right, well, anything else, Tom?
No, I think I've covered it all.
Excellent. All right, well, Derek, we appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you, man. Just let's stay in touch, and when the next album comes out, let's do this again.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
All and right. I'll text you when this is going to, the day before it goes up on all the platforms.
All right, so. Cool. Great. Cool, man. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Great All right. talking to you.
Derek, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, man.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye.